It will come to order. Messages from the House.
February the 9th, 2009, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill number 183, Military Tuition Assistance, Ayes 60. House Bill number 198, Wheat Marketing Commission Assessments, Ayes 60. House Bill number 235, Child Protection Case Planning, Ayes 60. House Bill number 252, Wyoming Retirement System Hospital Participation, Ayes 60. House Bill number 288, Certificate of Authority, High Voltage Transmission Lines, Ayes 59, Noes 1. February the 9th, 2009, from the House of Representatives, third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 226, State Land Grazing Leases, Ayes 58, Noes 1, Conflict 1. House Bill number 97, Weights and Measures, Ayes 60. House Bill number 163, Physician Assistant School, Ayes 57, Noes 3. House Bill number 176, B, X-ray Equipment Appropriation, Ayes 59, Noes 1. House Bill number 240, Elected State Officials Benefits, Ayes 37, Noes 23. House Bill number 291, Small Business Investment Credit, Ayes 56, Noes 4. House Bill number 262, Very Rare and Uncommon Areas, Ayes 37, Noes 23. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills on first reading. House Bill 235, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 235, sponsored by Representative Mercer, Child Protection Case Planning and Act Relating to Child Protection, passed the House on third reading, Ayes 60.
House Bill 235 is referred to committee number one, Judiciary. House Bill 252, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 252, sponsored by Representative Landon, Wyoming Retirement System Hospital Participation and Act Relating to the Wyoming Retirement System. Ayes passed the House on third reading, Ayes 60.
House Bill 252 is referred to committee number two, Appropriations. House Bill 198, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 198, sponsored by Representative Anderson, Wheat Marketing Commission Assessments and Act Relating to the Wheat Marketing Commission. Passed the House on third reading, Ayes 60.
House Bill 198 is referred to committee number five, Agriculture. House Bill 183, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 183, sponsored by Representative Escobel, Military Tuition Assistance and Act Relating to Educational Assistance for National Guard Members. Passed the House on third reading, Ayes 60.
House Bill 183 is referred to committee number 8, Transportation. House Bill 288.
House Bill number 288, sponsored by Representative Lockhart, Certificate of Authority, High Voltage Transmission Lines, and Act Relating to Utilities. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, noes 1.
House Bill 288 is referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. Considerations of bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that point.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Considerations of bill in general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate resolve itself back into the Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senator Honeycutt.
Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 04. The reading clerk will read the House bill.
House Bill number 4, sponsored by the Travel Commission, Game and Fish Immunial Contraceptives, an act relating to game and fish. It was referred to Committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Cole, Dockstader, Jennings, and Sessions. Senator Burns, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with favorable recommendation for House Bill 4. There are no amendments and there are no appropriations on this bill. Mr. Chairman, this was an interim committee bill on the part of the Joint Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources Interim Committee, and it deals with immunocontraceptives. Basically, what that is are... It's a drug that can be given to any number of animals that causes them to not procreate for the next 4 to 5 years. There is a new drug that is coming out. It is being FDA tested as we speak and should be legal and available within the next year or so. And what this bill does is allows Game and Fish to actually regulate the use of this on wildlife. Now, by wildlife, we're only talking about those animals which Game and Fish has authority over, not such animals as wild horses or those animals that might come under the Department of Agriculture. The concern that Game and Fish has expressed on this is that you may have various parties who may want to restrict reproduction and the numbers of herds of such things as deer as it affects their property. And without Game and Fish being able to regulate this, others could go out and apply these immunocontraceptives themselves, in which case the Game and Fish would, frankly, start losing control of these wildlife herds, not to mention the count. And so, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. It's a quite a simple bill. It's a policy decision on the part of the legislature, but I think this is something that is needed.
Any discussion? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, would this apply to wolves and other predators?
Senator Burns.
Not foreseen at this point, wolves being in a protected species at this point. It can be applied by DART when it becomes available.
Any further discussion? Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation for House Bill 2015-04, say aye. Aye. Opposed? House Bill 04 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 12.
House Bill number 12, sponsored by the Agriculture Committee, Brand Inspection Fees, an act relating to brand inspection fees. It was referred to Committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Jennings, Johnson, Vasey, and Geis, Senator Geis, Chairman.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move that House Bill 12 do pass, and I'll yield to Senator Jennings to explain the bill.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a pretty easy bill. Basically, what happens if you have a livestock truck going down the road, it wrecks, and you got livestock running all over the road, the Ag Board has to go in there and help catch them and get them all back together. And in doing so, they may have to go out and grab some panels and a trailer and some equipment that they don't actually carry around with them all the time. So they'll have to go rent it. And all this bill does is give them the authority to charge back to the owner or the responsible party for letting the livestock run out and about. So as you go through that on page one, it describes who, that it's reimbursable expenses, including transportation, supply, or equipment truck rental relating to the service by the board. Then if you follow it down, you see that it also says this subsection shall not apply to those services authorized under Wyoming Statute 1120-401. So if you go to 1120-401, you'll find out that that's brand inspection fees. And so the buck and a quarter for cattle, 25 cents for sheep, llamas, alpacas, the $9 for horses, and the $6.25 surcharge. If he's got to have panels, horse trailers, and stuff like that, he can't go back and get a reimbursement on that. So, Mr. Chairman, we really tried in committee to figure out how to put an amendment on this, and it was so well written we couldn't figure out how to do it. So I'd stand for questions and ask for your favorable vote.
Discussion? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, we've had a few circumstances where we turn up with a stray critter and put him in our corral and call the brand inspector because we can't figure out whose it is. Is that, with this bill, is something like that where the brand inspector does incur mileage and whatnot, coming out and running him down into our chute and shaving him and trying to figure out what the brand is. Is the brand inspector going to be able to charge extra for doing that, or is that already governed in the statute?
Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, and I may get corrected on this, but the way I understand it is if the brand inspector goes out in his pickup in his normal line of duty and he goes out there and identifies and drags it back, no. If he has to rent a trailer or any gear to drag it back to wherever it belongs, yes.
Further discussion. Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, further exploring and understand when a livestock truck tips over, about half of them, you're going to either have to shoot them to put them out of their misery or shoot them to get them out of the trailer. Does this go to things like tobaccos and stuff you need when you go to bury these things? Does this also, when they start talking about the responsible party, are you really talking about the trucker? Is that who you're talking about? Or is it going to be me as a landowner that lives along I-25 and pick up, depends how good the season is, but anywhere from 1 to 3 of these livestock trucks, particularly the ones that are long haul coming down from Canada, that go to sleep and tip over? How far does this go, and what does it encompass? By the way, it's very rare. If we're going to talk public safety, they don't stay on the interstate. I mean, when they come out of that truck, the ones that live, they just start running. And fences don't mean a lot to them. Are we opening a door there that, are you sure you want to open it? Because it gets pretty gory and it gets pretty expensive after a while. Who's going to pay in those kind of cases, which are where the big expenses come?
Senator Geist.
Mr. Chairman, in a truck wreck or anything like that, from my experience, my insurance company paid it all. To gather up the cattle, bury the cattle, do whatever has to do, they bill me and I bill my liability insurance and cargo insurance.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I'm getting at. My fear is that on the big ticket, it isn't the one or two strays that you get. It's the truck wrecks is where the dollars mount up. And it looks to me like we're shifting the cost from insurance companies onto the state of Wyoming, and particularly onto the brand inspection account. Last time I looked, we were supplementing it with general fund money anyway. It's not holding its own the way it's funded right now, and this is an additional expense. And if you tip over a truck or two, you'll be talking substantial that insurance companies will no longer be able to pick up, or they won't pick it up.
Senator Bebout.
I'll try to answer the question. As I understand it, listening to the testimony in committee, under existing law, when one of these wrecks occurs, it's the responsibility of the livestock board through the brand inspectors to go out there and police that and take care of it. That's already required of them. What this does is it says, okay, if you go out there to do it, we're going to let you recollect or be reimbursed for some of the expenses you had to incur. It was over and above the fact that the brand inspector went out there to do what they're required by law to do. Now, if I'm wrong, we'll sure get back to you with another answer, but that's what I thought the intent was to be able to do, not to get into the major wrecks and having the livestock board pay for that, but to reimburse them for expenses they incurred doing what the law required them to do.
Senator Schiffer.
And I'm not sure what the law requires you to do, but what in fact happens if you tip over a truck, and I'll use I-25 as an example, what happens is you get a call from here in Cheyenne from the Highway Patrol dispatcher saying there are cattle on I-25 at mile marker 162. And if you go out there, and if oftentimes there's a Highway Patrolman there, sometimes not, but they're always on the way. I will give them credit. But you can't leave them out there. And, you know, it isn't a question of calling your local brand inspector. He may or may not be available, and he may be able to get there. But the thing is, first of all, you go see what direction they ran, and or if you can. But it doesn't work that way. It really doesn't. That's why always before we bill the trucker's insurance company, because you got to go take care of it right then. It's not like calling the brand office, which actually isn't open when most wrecks happen.
Further discussion? Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, the problem seems to be that if the brand inspector does get there and he is required to go out and get additional equipment right now, panels or trailers or whatever to haul it off, lead for the guns, whatever, now is being paid by the state through their existence of being there. What they're asking us to do with this bill is to allow them to charge back to the owner or the one responsible for the cattle or the livestock that got out during the wreck. So right now we are paying it, and what they want to do is pass that on to the owner, who therefore passes it on, you know, either he pays it or it comes out of his insurance. So right now we are paying it. The idea is that we don't, in the future, we don't want to pay it.
Further discussion? Further discussion? Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill number 12, say aye.
Aye.
Oppose? House Bill 12 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 55.
House Bill number 55, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, Judicial Vacancies, and Act Relating to Courts. It was referred to Committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Geis, Landon, Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the Committee of the Whole rises to report, I ask that they do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 55. There is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
House Bill number 55, standing committee amendment number 1 to engrossed copy, page 1, line 3.
And, Mr. Chairman, I move standing committee number 1 to House Bill 55 and have the great Chairman of Judiciary explain this bill for us.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 55 was a joint Judiciary Interim Committee bill, the bill, if you had the original bill before you, would see that it consisted of three lines on the first page. And what the Standing Committee Amendment did was take out the House's committee amendment, or the House's amendment, take it back to the original bill. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a pretty simple bill, and it came about as a result of a situation that occurred with the recent retirement of a district court judge in Moreland. Of course, we have circuit court judges. The circuit court judge who was living in Thermopolis technically was the court in Bighorn County in Moreland, and he was selected to fill the seat of the vacant district court judge. You also had situations where you have some full-time elected magistrates in this circuit. And had it not been for the good graces of an attorney in Warland, a law school buddy of mine, same class, that said, you know, I won't stand for retention and create a problem, all this bill says is that in a situation where we use these weighted caseload studies to determine the work, it clearly was evident that the circuit court judge needed to reside in Warland. That's where all the caseload is in Washakie County, and that we just gave the Supreme Court the authority to be able to sit the judge where the caseload study says it should be. Now, what the House did was to go on and say, well, in the event that the Supreme Court requires a seated court judge to leave, then you have to pay for moving expenses and whatnot. And there, in talking with the Chief Justice, there is just not a situation where that would occur. This situation was filling of a new seat, making sure that the judge is in the county where the greatest caseload is. That's all it is, and would ask your favorable consideration of this. First of all, of the Standing Committee Amendment, to take the bill back to what it was, and for your approval of the bill.
Any discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment? Senator President Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my question is, then, if I'm interpreting it correctly, why should the Supreme Court tell someone where to live? I can see where they could tell him where to work, and he have to get there every day. That you gave the example of Worland. If the person wanted to live down the road in Thermopolis or Hot Springs or somewhere like that, why should we dictate to a person where they should live?
Senator Ross.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the answer to that is for judicial efficiency. And for we do that all the time when we fill a district court judge's slot. We may have a new district court judge in Cheyenne, and we may have several different applicants from all over. That's where the court sits. And the same thing is true in circuit court. Now, some of the circuit courts have to, they cover bigger areas than just one locale like Cheyenne, so maybe that's not a very good example. But in this particular example, there would still be, in Hot Springs, and I think there's one other county that's covered by that, Bighorn, that they still have full-time magistrates. So, but we want our judges to be in the locale where the greatest work is at. The alternative is then I guess we'd be paying for a lot of fuel and transportation costs that we really shouldn't have to. So it makes all the sense in the world. It just so happened that in this situation, the way in which this whole thing came about and the way in which the selection process occurred, we had this gap where the sitting judge was living in Thermopolis, but going up to Warland all the time to do his work, or allowing John Worrell, to handle all of the cases of the full-time magistrate, and clearly most of the cases are in Warland.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, is there any particular reason, following this logic out, that this bill should not be amended to apply to the Supreme Court?
Senator Ross, rebuttal.
Mr. Chairman, I suspect that the dark-haired fellow in the back there from Albany County prompted that question. we could really have a Donnybrook if we wanted to get into that again. The answer to that question is no.
Senator Burns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it says here the Supreme Court may determine where the court judge shall reside. You know, what's good for the goose should be good for the gander. So I don't understand why the bill can't be amended to apply to the Supreme Court.
Any more discussion? Senator Geis, or Coe, excuse me.
This is offended. I don't know which one it is, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you kind of got my interest up in this bill now. I was just wondering, I know we've had situations out there before with district court judges that haven't necessarily lived where they practice, and it happened up in Park County. I mean, a former district court judge in Park County actually lived in Powell, but did most of his practicing in Cody. And you mentioned something about transportation. Do we pay transportation charges or gasoline or anything for these guys if they live in Thermopolis and go over to Worland, and or if they live in Thermopolis and practice in Worland?
Senator Ross.
Well, the answer with regards to transportation is that we do. We do pay for that. And, you know, I can't address the Park County situation. It would seem to me that the judge was living within the district, within his judicial district, although I assume that they do a lot of traveling anyway, back and forth between Cody and Powell. Certainly, the bulk of the work should be in Cody, it would seem to me. I know our newest district court judge up there lives in Cody, but. Yeah, we do. We do pay for that, and I don't know what else I can say. I don't want to really go much further into the Supreme Court at this point in time.
Senator Larson.
I wonder if the sponsor knows, do we pay the transportation charges for the Supreme Court to go back and forth to work?
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a, you know, it's about the fourth quarter, and I'm deciding to punt that one to the to the appropriations chair. I'm sure he'll know real well.
Are you ready for the question? Any more? Oh, sorry. Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, along that very constructive line, when we do pay transportation, is it air transportation from wherever to Cheyenne, or do they drive like all of us legislators do?
Senator Nicholas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it is an air, one, as I didn't initiate that conversation, but it has been quite an interesting topic to me. My understanding is that, and I'm not aware of any budget for judges who live outside of Cheyenne to move in, and I'm told that those judges who do live outside of Cheyenne pay their own way, and it's up to them to go back and forth. And but it's a very interesting topic.
Further discussion? Question? Any question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Von Flateren's motion to adopt Standing Committee Number 1 to House Bill 55, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment has been adopted. Comments, discussions on the bill itself, House Bill 55. Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Von Flateren's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 55, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
House Bill 55 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for consideration is House Bill 5.
House Bill Number 5, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, Interstate Compact for Supervision of Parolees Repeal, and Act Relating to Criminal Procedure. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of House Bill 55. Senator Ross.
House Bill 5.
House Bill 5.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee whole rise and report it, do so with a due pass recommendation for House Bill 5. And for a explanation of this bill, I yield to the good senator from Sheridan.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman. House Bill 5. Repeals, first of all, it was an interim committee bill on the part of the Joint Judiciary Interim Committee. It repeals 713.412 through 713.417. If you go and look in your statutes, you will see that that is the Interstate Compact for Supervision of Parolees and Probationers. This was a compact that was passed initially in 1947 and was amended a number of times since. There was another compact that was passed in 2001, and if you move in your again in your statutes over to 713.422, that is the replacement compact. As I said, the state passed it in 2001, but the compact does not become effective until 35 states have passed it. The 35th state passed it in 2005, so it is now going to take effect, or actually has taken effect, deeming 412 through 417 to be redundant and useless, so therefore we are repealing it from the statutes. And for further explanation or questions, I would be glad to answer.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 05, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? House Bill 5 has passed this Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 9.
House Bill 9, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, Subdivisions, Cluster Developments, and Act Relating to Subdivisions. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Elections Political Subdivision. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, Hastert, Johnson, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
Senator Case.
Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 9, there is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
House Bill 9, standing committee amendment number 1 to engrossed copy, page 1, line 5.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the standing committee amendment to House Bill 9. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to talk about both these things together. This is a product of your interim corporations committee work. It creates a new article and adds a new way that we can have subdivisions in Wyoming. And it's a way to create subdivisions which is sensitive to the amount of open space in the parcel that's brought in to be subdivided. And the whole essence of the bill is that it gives a bonus to developers who group their dwellings closer together and yet at the same time leave more of the bulk of the subdivided property open and devoted to some kind of use which can be defined as open space, which is defined in the bill. We'll get to that. But the essence is, you know, right now a lot of subdivisions come in they're either, you can get around subdivision requirements by having just cutting a parcel up into 35-acre tracts. And so you can imagine a full section, maybe 640 acres, and you can imagine 35-acre tracts scattered around there, and the entirety of the area is used for dwelling purposes. And it's sort of a bad way to develop land in a way. If you think about it, talk about the maximum amount of roads that you'd need, the maximum difficulty in providing a centralized water and sewer system, the maximum difficulty getting the kids to school. You just pick the difficulties, and the more you spread the dwellings out on the parcel, the worse it gets. Not to mention light pollution, Mr. Chairman. You know, and you got all those little parcels. Each one of them's got a yard light, and you can see where I'm going with this, and I'm sure you can be prevailed why it might be good to have an alternative. And it is an alternative because it is fully optional. And that's a very important part of the bill. If you look at the bottom of page 1, it's called Article 1. It's an entire new article that is created. The existing subdivision statute is Article 3. This goes right behind it. It's Article 4. And turn the page to the top of page 2, and this is a key to the bill. The Board of County Commissioners in each county, by resolution, may establish, regulate, and control a conservation design process for the unincorporated area in the county as provided in this article. So if it's a part of the county that's not incorporated into a town or municipality, they may, by resolution, develop it according to this design process. But it's may. It's not shall. They don't have to adopt it. Sort of like outdoor lighting. They don't have to adopt it. But, Mr. Chairman, we proceed. 185402 has important definitions. Lines 10 through 15 is the definition of conservation design process. It means a planning process adopted by a county to offer a land use option for residential purposes that differs from traditional 35-acre divisions of land described in a regular subdivision bill and using cluster development and density bonuses. We're going to talk about those to preserve open space through. And you got two ways that open space or two purposes by which open space can exist. Lines 17 and 18 for the protection of wildlife habitat and critical areas, or lines 20 through 23 talks about the continuance and maintenance of traditional agricultural operations. And you can sort of see where this is going. One way that we can preserve open space is to basically have the farm ranch operation develop some of their land so that they can stay in business, but keep the core of the land available and maintain it in agriculture. That's permitted under this act. So in that way, they can get the density of dwellings on their land. We get the open space. They get to keep their operations in the family. So that's only one way. Another definition, Cluster development means any division of land that creates parcels containing less than 35 acres each, provided that one or more of the parcels are divided pursuant to a county conservation design process. B, there's a limitation on the area. It says an area within the county equal to not less than two-thirds of the total area of the parcel as defined, and that statute just defines parcel. So two-thirds of the total acre of the parcel being divided is reserved at the time of development for the preservation of open space in furtherance of one or more of the objectives described in paragraph I of this subsection. I was on that previous page. That was critical wildlife or maintenance of family agriculture. Lines 15 through 18 on page 3, unless otherwise provided through a density bonus, the gross overall density shall not exceed one residential unit for each 17 and a half acres. What's the magic of 17 and a half acres? Well, it happens to be half of 35. You basically get double the density. But there is a way you can even go further, and that's what's called the density bonus, Mr. Chairman. Lines 20 through 23, land set aside to preserve open space or to protect wildlife habitat or critical areas shall not be developed in any way that changes its open space designation for at least 65 years. 65 years. When this bill left the committee, it actually had 99 years. And down the hall, they put in 65 years. So it's going to be maintained as a critical wildlife habitat for 65 years. Lines 4 through 7 talks about density bonuses. And really all this says is that you can have a lot more houses there if you qualify for a density bonus. How would you qualify? Well, the county commissioners might have some specific requirements that you would have to do in order to qualify for the density bonus. But you can see there's some guidelines, a gross overall density of 2, but the key words at the end of line 6 and beginning of line 7, or more residential units for each 35 acres. So it's open-ended. Finally, lines 9 through 18 is the description of open space, Mr. Chairman. This is kind of important. Open space means an area of land or water that is substantially free of structures, impervious surfaces, roads, and other land-altering activities, and does not, this is a key, does not include lands used for private recreation, such as golf courses and residential yards. You can't count that as open space. Areas devoted to parking, vehicular traffic, non-agricultural private use, or any other use which does not significantly lend itself to the furtherance of one or more of the objectives described. Remember, it's critical wildlife or family farming, basically. Open space includes lands used for agricultural activities. And then we define, subdefine things like private recreation, residential unit. And you can see that residential unit, this is a new thing in Wyoming subdivision law. You can actually have multifamily developments under this. So residential unit can include multifamily. And that's different. You know, you could literally have an apartment complex or a condominium development fulfill part of this if the county decides that that's something they want to work towards and it's incorporated in their planning activity. So then it talks about the permits, Mr. Chairman, under 185403. And it's kind of the standard stuff. It's a little bit like the permitting required process under Article 3. You got to have a record a plat, get a permit, and what you have to do to get a permit. Page 6, too little I, Mr. Chairman. This is under a permit shall not be approved until a provision is approved by the board, that's the Board of County Commissioners, providing for the designation of the open space, which may be evidenced by conservation easements, restrictive covenants, dedication of open space to the public, where dedication will be accepted by the governing body, or any other evidence accepted by the board or approved by the board. So the board can decide what is the proof that this is going to be an open space. And you'll see, again, provision requires that it be an open space for 65 years. Remember, it left the interim committee had 99 years. So the board makes a finding that they've done it, and they can grant them an application. And here's another key. It involves the agricultural taxing classification. And in essence, what we're saying is, you know, if you really do this and you have this property in open space and it's maintained in family agriculture or some other kind of agriculture, but it's maintained in agriculture, that portion of the parcel ought to qualify for the agricultural classification and pay less taxes. And I brought that up because that's also the subject of the amendment, Mr. Chairman. But we'll just take a look at that. Lines 21, page 6. If the open space areas created pursuant to permit issued under this article are used for agricultural purposes and otherwise qualify as agricultural land for purposes of the, you can see it's a Title 39 statute, that's taxation, then the area designated as open space shall be deemed not to be part of a platted subdivision for purposes of our taxation policy. Because in our tax law, it says if it's part of the platted subdivision, you are not agriculture. That's what it says right now. And so this creates an exception and says, not, forget what that says. If you follow this process and it's called open space and it's maintained in agricultural production, then you're not going to be considered a platted subdivision for purpose of taxation. Yes, you are a platted subdivision for all the other county requirements. It's just to get around the taxes. Are you with me? That is the bill, Mr. Chairman. There's some rules and regulations. Notice to the state engineer. That's so that they can, the state engineer can get involved in the water issues, and has adequate notice about that. Section 2, Mr. Chairman, is exemption for provisions. It says, unless the method of sale or other disposition is adopted for purposes, this is old language, of evading the provisions of this article, the article shall not apply to the following subdivisions of land. However, the following subdivisions are subject to requirements which may be adopted by the Board of County Commissioners regarding documentation, the proper use, and implementation of the following exemptions. And one of the exemptions is a division which creates a cluster development pursuant to and in accordance with Article 4 of this chapter. Mr. Chairman, it's got an effective date of July 1, 2009, but as we move to the amendment, and let's pick that up right now, that you can see that the amendment has separate effective dates. Here's the gist of what the amendment does. It's sort of a what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander kind of amendment. So the amendment literally goes into Article 3, which is our other subdivision statute, and says, you know what? If you have 140 acres used in agriculture under this statute, it will also qualify for the agricultural classification of taxation. That's the gist of it. And you can see there's 18.5.318 in the amendment, and I'm on the amendment now. That's lines 11 through 19. Actually, it's 11 through 24. That goes into the existing subdivision statute and puts in that language. Lines 25 to 39, that's the Title 9 or Title 39 taxation. Anything says Title 39, that's taxation. And it goes in there and it says, you know, that was kind of awkward language that I talked about before. Let's make sure that it's clear that because it's in Title 9 as well. And you can see on lines 36 through 38, under 2, it says the land is not part of a platted subdivision. And this closes the, wraps it up in a bow, except for a parcel of 140 acres or more, which other qualifies as agricultural land. Creates that exception in Title 39. So in essence, you've got it in 18 Article 3, 18 Article 4, which is created by this statute, and in Title 39. Finally, Mr. Chairman, if you look on the back of the last second page of the amendment, that has to deal with effective dates. And the reason we have this split effective date is because for taxation purposes, the assessors need to be able to apply it to the tax year 2009. So it's literally retroactive on the taxation policy so that when the assessors, next time they send out assessments for 2009, it will apply and be applicable this year for those agricultural classifications. The rest of the bill is effective July 1. Now, a little bit more about the taxation here. We have another bill in committee. It's called Subdivision Requirements. And we're going to put the same, the committee already has moved to put the same tax deals in that bill so that we have the two bills dealing with subdivisions have this consistent tax language as they move forward. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to discuss the amendment. We probably ought to in a way it's kind of wrapped up in the whole bill. Maybe you'll be lenient about both of them, Mr. Chairman. Be happy to answer any questions, and I hope I get some support from the good senator from Natrona County, who really did a lot of work on this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the standing committee amendment, a question. Would you, why not 35 acres? Why did we come up with 140? As I recall, the law goes from 35 to 140. So you've taken the high end. If it's for agricultural use, you have to go through a procedure to come up with agricultural use. Why not have it at 35, or is there something I'm missing?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And just to update on that, I mean, ultimately a year ago, we changed the 35-acre amount to 140, if what my recollection was. A year ago, we changed that 35-acre exemption. We gave the county commissioner authority to expand that up to 140 acres, and that leads to my question. That's part of it has to do with your, but mine dovetails into his, is ultimately with the 35, I was just wondering why you decided maybe that it shouldn't be dovetailed into whatever the county commissioners decide is the exempt amount, whether it's 35 or 100 or 140, that it shouldn't be dovetailed into that. And that, this is just a question for you.
Mr. Chairman, in the large acre subdivision that we passed last year, I believe there's a very similar provision there that says those 35 to 140 are ag if they otherwise qualify as ag. So that covers the 35 to 140, and we figured it would be, frankly, a good deal less controversial if we went from 140 above here. So that's basically why we did it. Once you get to 140 acres, absent something strange going on with the land, you've got enough land, so you're very likely to qualify as agricultural. Can be used that way. That's enough grazing land. So we figured that it would make sense to go from 140 up, because the 35 to 140 is covered that way in the a large acre subdivision already.
Mr. Chairman, I want to be sure that under that provision, though, what if it's platted? Is that the deciding factor? Because here it specifically says platted or part thereof, whereas that statutes that we have existing may say if it's not platted, but it may apply.
Mr. Chairman, the platted language is because that's what the tax code uses already. If it's part of a platted subdivision, the current law is that it can't be ag. We made an exception to that last year in the 35 to 140, the large acre. This is coming in a similar exception for the 140 and above that is part of a platted subdivision.
I would like to also point out that if you come in under a cluster development, conceivably there's really no limit on the size of the parcel for that exemption. The 100, I think that's right. And well, I'm getting a nod from the other side. I better correct myself, and we will check on that. But Mr. Chairman, I better just shut up, probably. But that's the way it started out, but it may not be that way anymore. Mr. Chairman, I think you have to look at this in terms of the large acre subdivision parcel bill we passed last year, and the fact that this bill dealt just with cluster developments, but we decided to reach in and do the 140 acres. That was certainly the support issued by your assessors. Believe me, they find it more difficult to administer the smaller parcels and to deal with whether or not it's ag or not. I suppose that's going to be a policy call on the part of this body, but if you do look into the language of the large acre subdivision last year, you'll actually see that same exception. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I want to point out there is another bill coming, and our hope is to have both of them be amended in a very similar manner so that there's no confusion about this statute as we move forward. I call for the question on the amendment if anybody's ready.
Okay, we'll do this again. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee number 1 to House Bill 9, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment has passed. Now we're on to the bill, House Bill 9. Senator Coe.
Make me understand one thing about this bill. If you use this conservation design process, you're going to go in and be able to treat all those parcels and tax them as if they're ag land. I think that's what it says. My question is, how can you do that constitutionally when you have residential developments out there, subdivisions, that might have 17.5 acres in one and 17.5 acres under this new design process? That land's going to be taxed as residential, be taxed at a different rate. My question goes to how you can constitutionally tax two identical, not identical, but like pieces of property, one at subdivision residential rates, one at ag rates. My understanding, having been a commissioner like a number have been here, a parcel to be a viable agricultural unit for a long time was classified as 40 acres. They allowed counties to be more restrictive. In Park County, we used to use 35. Basically, that said that if you didn't have at least 35 acres of land, you couldn't have a viable agricultural unit. That's my question. How can we tax in a residential subdivision at residential rates and tax under this provision at ag rates for a like piece of property?
Discussion. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, my mind is very well jogged now, and the answer is we didn't do that. And that's exactly the answer when the senator from Natrona County was nodding his head vigorously, that it's consistent. We reached into the regular subdivision statute, Article 3, to make sure that's the subject of the first part of this amendment, to allow for the exception for 140 acres, just like there's the same exception under cluster development. We're talking about the open space part of the subdivision. We're not talking about the individual parcels. Now, if they could be conceived, different parts of them can be conceived as being part of the open space, you might be able to pull it in there. But there is a limit on the size, and it has to be maintained in agricultural use and has to be the part dedicated open space. That's the part that gets the taxation classification as agriculture. And then if we would have done that on a cluster subdivision bill, and not gone into the other subdivision statute, we might have had that exact problem you deal with. If you had developed your land under one arrangement, it qualifies, yet you have the same land developed in another way, but it's the same parcels, it doesn't qualify, and that would be unconstitutional. So that's why it's in both places.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I quite understand, having been in that position good senator from Park County was talking about is the way that the commissions generally look at it is once it's platted as a subdivision, it's platted as residential land, no matter what type of division of land was within that subdivision. So it's taxed all under the residential tax codes. But one of the things, what we did in this particular bill is that we tried to I get back to the section I'm looking for. We tried to reach also into the tax code, which was in the amendment 3913103 under imposition, and we tried to draw out that section of open space, which would be the 140, and tax that as a separate agriculture unit. But I understand the difficulty, I guess, in understanding that, because you're right, to the good senator from Park County, that's absolutely correct, is that that in the past it's always been that once you platted that piece of ground as a subdivision, then it was definitely taxed, all of it, as residential property tax. But we've tried to go in Title 39 and pull that out and set up a different situation for the taxation of this 140 acres that we've set out. I don't know if that answers it, but I do understand where you're going.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. And we were concerned with the law in the absence of the provision here that you would get disparate treatment that would not be constitutional, where you had a parcel, large parcel, 140 acres, that was normally, that was treated as ag because that's what it was, and then one that, because it was in a planted subdivision, was not treated as ag, even though it was big and was a viable ag piece. So we felt it's important. Now there's another circumstance here, and that is, as I read the bill, within a cluster subdivision, you could have a smaller piece of land that was open space, and that could still be treated as ag if that's what it was, but you have to dedicate it for that period of years to being ag, and so there's a special qualification there. In addition to it otherwise qualifying as land, it has to be preserved that way, whereas in a say your 17.5-acre lot in a regular subdivision, that's not dedicated at all. You can build on that tomorrow. So that's not the same as other ag land, and that was the distinction.
Further discussion? Senator Sessions.
Chairman, I have a couple of questions. On page 3, C, under that, I just want to, just to double check to make it clear in my mind, if you have opened that up to divide your 35-acre plots into 17.5 acres, if you only have two of those, one each 17.5 acres, does that mean then that you still have to have two-thirds of that 35-acre plot in an open space agreement? And I guess...
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, in answer to that question, no, you wouldn't. That those are part of your of the large parcel of land. Those are part of the part that says this is a subdivision. It's 17.5. The open space part is outside of that. That's where it qualifies as ag through the income or the rental agreement or gross revenue, you know, the standard qualifications to become an ag parcel. And they wouldn't be. They're part of the subdivision part of it.
Senator Sessions.
Just a couple of other questions on then on this, in this structure, we don't do anything about requirements for water, sewer, anything. We leave that all up to the county commissioners what are they called? Cluster developments, then. That's entirely up to your county, then, what happens under that scenario.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The way that works to the good senator from Laramie is that you're right. That falls under the planning and zoning rules of the county, and that really is up to either if you have a planning and zoning board or commission within your county, and also the county commissioners. So those fall under those rules. Any of the conditions for water, sewer, roads, and those type of infrastructure things, that does definitely fall under your local planning and zoning board or the commission if you don't have a planning and zoning commission. But
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions to make sure that I understand it, since we worked on it in the summer, but it is my understanding, with the may in there, that this does not obligate any county that may already be able to do this through zoning that they already have implemented. This in no way requires them to use this process, is really question number one. And number two is, this really is a process that if they do have planning and zoning, they could go ahead and do by themselves without having to use this methodology. Are those two suppositions still correct?
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, this is completely an option. And if a county does have planning and zoning, and they can pursue this sort of thing right now, it's possible. This probably makes it a little easier in some instances, makes it clearer, and it defined some terms which counties had not defined outside of perhaps your county, Senator Larson. The biggest part of this and the benefit, Mr. Chairman, is that we have a tool that's fairly simple in state statute that's optional that allows for more open space to be preserved, higher density developments to occur, but, you know, the developments can occur in a more responsible manner. More opportunity for centralized utility services, centralized roads, and people can all, rather than just chopping up in 35-acre parcels or whatever and sprawling out with all those yard lights, we can actually develop responsibly, maintain a portion of the land in agriculture, clearly indicating that agriculture classification can apply. And, Mr. Chairman, it's just a better way to move forward. It's more, and it just makes for the difference between huge sprawling squares and wonderful design communities that people really do enjoy. This is a good tool to have.
Are you ready for the question? Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, just one other follow-up question under your definition on page 4 on residential unit. And I assume that means a parcel that's in there. And it says a structure or part of a structure containing dwelling units, and it goes on to say, you know, two family and all that other stuff. Am I prohibited if I buy a residential unit from having an outbuilding or putting a little barn on this deal or doing something like everybody else does out in the country?
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think outbuildings qualify as dwelling units, so I don't think it means anything with respect to outbuildings. I mean, it would be... this allows the subdivider to come in and say, we can have, in this parcel, three dwelling units and a townhouse. They could be in triangles and all the dwelling units are right here. But it's not talking about the outbuildings and things like that. They may be covered elsewhere, but they're not covered as a definition of a dwelling unit.
Senator Scott.
Chairman, my reading of it is that outbuildings and that sort of thing will be governed by the county zoning regulations, and that'll take care of it.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 9, say aye. Opposed? House Bill 9 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 25.
House Bill number 25, sponsored by Representative Illoway, Special License Plate Retention by Spouse, and Act Relating to Special License Plates. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Geis, and Landon. No, Senator Von Flatron. Senator Von Flatron, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Von Flatron?
Recommendation of House Bill 25, and to explain the bill would be Senator Escobel.
Senator Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring to you House Bill number 25, Special License Plate Retention by Spouse. And on first blush, you would all think that this is basically a bill about license plates. But it's a bill about a little bit more than that. It's about how you feel about a surviving spouse. When you lose a spouse, it's, of course, a very traumatic event. And, I think most people, when they lose a spouse, they like to have something to remember them by. Well, this is one way of remembering their deceased spouse. As it stands right now, Wyoming National Guard member or a Purple Heart recipient are eligible for special license plates. This bill would allow their surviving spouse to keep that license plate upon the license plate's owner's death. And that's basically what this bill is about. It provides for the surviving spouse to maintain the license plate that the deceased spouse was eligible for during his or her lifetime. Mr. Chairman, I do have a Committee of the Whole amendment also, and I would like to move that at this point, if I might.
The reading clerk.
House Bill 25, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 9.
Amendment number one, committee of the whole amendment to committee of the whole amendment number one to House Bill 25. This amendment basically clarifies the eligibility of the surviving spouse, that the surviving spouse can maintain that special license plate as long as he or she remains unmarried. Now you might ask, what happens if he or she decides to remarry? Well, I don't know if they, I don't know if this would be a deal breaker, but upon remarriage, the eligibility would cease, and that's what this amendment is for. And I would ask your favorable vote on amendment Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 25.
Discussion. Are you ready for the question? Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator von Flederen's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill Number 25, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 25 has passed. On to the next one.
Mr. Chairman, now, there is a Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2, and that is by Senator Burns. Do you wish to talk to this one, Mr. Burns? Or?
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2 to House Bill 25. Mr. Chairman,
Sorry, point of order, second. Sorry, I messed up. We need to read the amendment in, Senator Burns.
Oh, okay.
House Bill number 25, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2, delete the Escobel Committee of the Whole Amendment.
Senator Burns.
I now at the proper time move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2 to House Bill 25. Mr. Chairman, this is one of those bills that just bothers me. I know it bothers the other senator from Laramie County. We just don't like the idea of decorating up and hanging ornaments on the license plates because it takes away from the role of the license plate. In this particular case, I brought this amendment for two reasons. One is the fact that once a spouse loses their spouse who was in the National Guard or was a Purple Heart recipient, the amendment allows them to keep that license plate until the rotation, the recycling, or not recycling, but the cycling of the license plates, which happens every 8 years. And the reason I bring this amendment is twofold. One is, once the person who had gotten the license plate in the first place, be they a National Guard member or a Purple Heart recipient, expired, we don't really need to go out and make the widow change the license plate out. Let them keep it for the rest of the cycle. But on the other hand, I don't think that they should necessarily have that license plate for the rest of their lives. The idea behind the license plate, behind the National Guard license plate or the Purple Heart recipient license plate, is to identify that person as the recipient or as the member of the National Guard, not as the widow or widower of somebody who was a Purple Heart recipient or National Guard member. The other problem, and the other reason I have the deletion of the Escobar Amendment, frankly, is the DMV, the Department of Transportation, does not go through wedding files. They don't know who's gotten married and who hasn't gotten married, and if they do get married or remarried, I don't see any particular reason why they need to change their license plate out until, again, the natural cycling of the license plates. We have one ongoing right now, so the next one won't come for 8 years yet. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to take any questions on this amendment.
Discussion. Ready for the question. Question's been called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns's motion to adopt its Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 25, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Number 2, Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 25 has passed. We're now on the bill. Senator Escobar.
Again, Mr. Chairman, I would just ask for your favorable vote on House Bill 25, and thank you.
Question. Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Von Flateren's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 25, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 25 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for consideration is House Bill 62. Will the clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 62, sponsored by the Education Committee, Charter School Law Amendments, an act relating to charter schools. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Cole, DeCarrier, Jennings, Massey, Von Flateren, Senator Cole, Chairman.
Senator Cole.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the do pass recommendation on House Bill 62, and there is a standing committee amendment. Ask that it be read in at this time.
House Bill number 62, Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to engrossed copy, page 2, line 23.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, move the Standing Committee Amendment and ask for favorable support. This is nothing more than a technical correction. A statute got inserted improperly, and we corrected that with this amendment. Question on the amendment.
Question has been called on the amendment. Those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt a Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 62, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We are on the bill. Yes, Senator Coe. Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a result of a education subcommittee on charter schools about 3 years ago. And what we did is we asked the Department of Education to come up with a step-by-step approach to charter schools. I believe that was about the time that the Lander School was turned down. Quite a few people were heated up about the process. So since then, we've been slowly going through and looking at that. Basically, Mr. Chairman, what we've done here, so we start on page 1, line 16, and we just tell the department that they're going to go through and do this step-by-step components, which most of this has been completed. They just have to put it out now. But the important part of this, Mr. Chairman, is that we add the mediation portion into it. And if you look at line 10 on page 2, the Wyoming Statute 143-101, that's how to mediate. So we're just telling them to go back to those sections, do how we mediate normally right now. And so if you don't like what the your decision on your application for charter school is, rather than that being the end of it, that you can actually go to mediation. Each side has to pay their share of the mediation. Mr. Chairman, as you go back through the bill, that you'll see we, on page 2, line 22, We've added except as prescribed under phase application. That's in front of the direction on how to do the charter school. Again, on line 8, we've done that, and that's on the how you do review the application in public hearing. That goes back so that if you don't like what you're getting, that you can go to mediation. And, Mr. Chairman, as we get over to page 4, you see on line 12, we refer to notwithstanding 2113, the rest of that, that's what describes the three-year rolling average. And then, Mr. Chairman, we go down to page 4, line 17. That statute there on line 18 is how to do application for charter school and conversion of a current school. And you can see we've described the average daily membership computed under the paragraphs as multiplied by 2. We haven't really changed anything there. And, Mr. Chairman, then we go back on page 5 and line 2, 3, and 4, and that just refers back to the other ones for the changes that we made. Mr. Chairman, this is basically pretty simple. It gives you an outline, 1, 2, 3, 4, how to do it. If you don't like what the results of one becomes, then you go to mediation. Both sides pay their share of it, and you slug it out, and whatever the mediator tells you, you go for. Mr. Chairman, believe that in all of the charter school negotiations and debate, this may be one of the easiest ways to kind of settle it down and have everybody just go do their job and sit there and go through it, because you do have the avenue now to go out to mediation. Mr. Chairman, stand for questions and hope your favorable consideration of the bill.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm not as familiar with the charter school laws as I might be. You know, up in our district, it hasn't been a big issue because of the way the school board behaves with the choice schools within the district. But it's my observation that mediation tends to work best if there's some outside party that's empowered to make a decision if one or more of the parties is unreasonable and doesn't want to mediate. So the threat of having an outside party make a decision one way or t'other tends to focus both the parties on desirability to be reasonable and come out of mediation with a conclusion. And my question for you is here, is there such an outside party that can make a decision, yes or no, on the charter school application that will tend to focus, because having such a party will focus the parties to the mediation on the desirability to be reasonable and come out with a good result?
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, just to answer the good senator from Natrona County's question, if you go to page 2, line 12, I won't go through all that, but it starts by saying, any mediation process prescribed by rule shall specify professional requirements for the impartial third party facilitating mediation. It goes on to say, if either party refuses to mediate, the dispute may be appealed to the state board as provided in Wyoming Statute 21-3-310. Hope that answers your question.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, so the state board's empowered to say, yes, school district, you got to go ahead and do this charter school, or no, you cannot?
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In hopes to shed some light on the mediation, although I don't sit on education, I've been in a number of mediations. Mediation is not what the good senator from Natrona County is talking about, where one individual make that decision. That would be arbitration. Mediation is simply an attempt with a qualified mediator to bring the parties together and resolve it. Unless you require it to be binding, you would not have the result or the desired result that I think that you're seeking.
Further discussion. Senator Nichols.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on that a little bit, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Ordinarily, non-binding mediation, which is under the statutes that are identified there, is something that you do before you go to the exercise of having a decision made. So if you have a trial, you go and you mediate before, it's non-binding, and there is no determination made, then you go to the trial and you go on to it, you get a trial and you can appeal the decision. And the gentleman from Natrona County explained something that doesn't quite mesh with my thinking here, and that is that if the notion is you're going to have a non-binding mediation before the school board makes a determination, fair enough. If you insist and mandate that people participate in that non-binding mediation, then what you've done is you've imposed a pretty significant cost on the applicant by saying that he has to pay half, which becomes a barrier and not an assistance, because believe me, if you don't think mediation process is cheap, wait till you go through it. You've got to pay your lawyers. You've got to have now the third party in, facilitating. And then I'm puzzled by the notion that if either party refuses to mediate, the dispute may be appealed to the state board. Now, I assume that's the dispute over whether you mediate as opposed to what the resolution is, because you'd mediate first. If you don't come to a resolution, then you go in front of the proceedings where you go before the state, or the school board to have a determination. And maybe I'm missing something in the new text, but what I see here is an appeal before you've even gotten to the school board, unless you've taken away from the school board the ultimate decision to make it a decision on a charter. So if we get an explanation, is this a non-binding mediation that takes place before you have your hearing in front of the board to determine whether they're going to do the application, or if the notion is you have the application process, they deny it, and then you go to mediation, that seems a little absurd to me, but I'd like if we figure out what it is.
Senator Coe.
Remember that the bottom of page one, we talk about charter applications contents. We talked about a phased-in application process, and that's really the key to this whole paragraph. The state board, through rule and regulation, established a phased application process. It goes on to say halfway down page two, on line six, it says the phased application process prescribed by state board rule and regulation may provide a process for mediation of disputes between the applicant and the school district. So remember, we're talking about a phased-in application process here that has been a problem when we look at what's happened with charter schools. Particularly, there's one right here in Laramie County. You use the phased-in application process. All that says is that it may include a process for mediation. Ultimately, after the third party possibly comes in and either the district or the charter school have the right to start that process, ultimately the state board is the one that makes the decision if they can't mediate it. So remember, this paragraph is more about a phased-in application process that we felt was integral to what we do with charter schools based on the study we had done, I think, 2 years ago.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess there is a reason to have lawyers in the legislature. Thank you. But if you go down and look at the on page two, if either party refuses to mediate, the dispute may be appealed to the state board, and that's already in statute to say if you can't get along, then you can appeal to the state board. So I think the description in the question is correct, that as you go along this phased application, if there's a place that you can't see eye to eye, you have the ability to go to mediation. But if one party refuses to go to mediation, then you automatically jump to where we are right now and go to the state board.
Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, well, you know, I've been through this process at representing the charter school in Albany County and applied for and received that application after we drafted the legislation here at the insistence of the good former speaker from Fremont County. And the way the process works is you go in and you have to demonstrate you have community support. Then after this community support, you begin to develop the, you submit a proposed contract, and the contract's either rejected or accepted. And having met and conferred with the people in Cheyenne, I think their idea was is that what would happened in Albany County is there came a time where the board said, we're going to have a charter school. Let's begin the process of negotiating the contract, and that's a complicated 3 or 4 month process. What's the content? What are you going to teach? What time of core curricula? Are you offering something that we have? You're offering something new. How are you going to ensure that we have we're beating AYP, all of those things, a complicated process. I'm assuming the notion was is that we ought to be able to first determine whether there's level of support. If there's level of support, then what happens? Do you get to go to phase two? And is that an appealable decision? Why would I have to draft the contract if I can't demonstrate phase one? Or once I demonstrate phase one, should I be entitled to phase two? And I submit to you, since you have not changed any part of the existing statute, which is the process whereby the school board gets to make the determination, all you've done is put in two more layers of potential appeal to make it more complicated. If what you want to do is make charter school easier to obtain or even more methodical, you must go into the decision-making process of who makes the decision, the school board, and what is the criteria against which you get to decide. But if right now the language is, what I've seen is that you have a phased application process, which you're now delegating to the state board to do, which is an appointed board. They're not elected. And incidentally, in the past have not been that friendly to charter schools. And then you, they do regulations to phase, so phase one, phase two, phase three, and then you mediate it. You still have to have, at each given phase, you've got to have a decision. Are you going to mediate before the decision is made or after the decision made? And really, having, as my colleague points out in Laramie County, having participated in many, many mediations over the lifetime, my lifetime, I don't know how you mediate something post-dispute. Now, there are mechanisms where you appeal to the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they require you to have a mandatory mediation, a resolution of your case after the appeal. So you sit there, you've already won or you've already lost. Judges still make you mediate one time. And I've seen, you know, cases where you've had $10 million worth of damage claims, you lost, and you settle it there for $25,000. In this case, I'm not quite getting it. And then the issue is you still have to, the mediation process, when you begin to talk about what is the content of the contract and what should go into it, there is a collaboration that's required. And it's difficult if the school district says, we're not going to collaborate, we're not going to help you, you just keep making changes and we'll tell you how far you've jumped. And, of course, you can never jump high enough because you make changes and changes. But that is not going to be obviated because your decision-making still belongs to the school board. So if you say the dispute may be appealed to the state board, I don't know what a dispute is. You've got to have a final determination to appeal. Well, you appeal a dispute? Of course you have a dispute. That's why you're there. And what aspect of a dispute do you appeal? I apologize. I'm just not getting the mechanics of where you're intending to go.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is what I remember from the interim committee work. The mediation that we're talking about here only applies to subsection A of 21.3.307. And taking a look at 21.3.307, there are 22 elements in putting an application together to go to the board. What some of the charter school proponents in the past have been concerned about is that they believe that they've included some of those 22 elements in their application. The school board receives the application developed in subsection A, and then they go on to, or in 21.3.307, they take that application, and then in 21.3.308 proceed through the decision-making process, which my a colleague from Albany County just mentioned. Well, they get done with the hearing, they get done reviewing the application, and they say, well, three of those 22 elements, we don't agree that you met. We don't agree that you really submitted a complete application to us, so we're going to deny it. And so the applicants are saying, well, why didn't you tell us that to start with? And the school board said, well, we didn't need to, or we didn't think that the statutes permitted us to do that. So this provision here only applies to the elements that are submitted with the application and nothing that goes on after that. So as a result, if the school board says, well, four of these 22 elements here, we don't think that you've met, we don't think that it really qualifies as an application, and we dispute that you're really meeting these 22 elements. The charter school applicants can come back and say, no, we think we are meeting the letter of the law here. At that particular point, the Board of Education may, and they don't have to, but they may put into rules and regs a process for the two sides to mediate out that dispute on whether or not they've sent in a complete application and have met all those 22 elements. If they can't agree through a mediation process, then the argument over that application element goes to the school board. They can make a final decision. It then goes back to the application process. This does not apply once the application has been submitted and they move on to the decision-making process. The existing decision-making process may have also wind up with the Wyoming Board of Education. This one just simply allows them to begin disputing specific parts or elements of the application before the school board has to make a decision.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that was a lot of what came out of the subcommittee, is it was the discussion on the entire application, much as the my fellow senator on education described, is that you would finish the application, the school board would say no, you'd have a certain amount of time to appeal it or argue it, but then you'd have to find out which it was. So what we put back to the department out of that subcommittee was you have these 20-some elements, 22 elements that you have to do, divide them up. So you have the first, you know, whether it's, you know, four sections or three or whatever you want, but you'd have this section of the elements, you work on them, then you push them over to the school board, and they tell you yes or no, they sign off on them, they disagree, but you find the point at that point, what you agree on, what you disagree on. Then we ask them to, you know, take them to the next. Once they sign off on that section of elements, then you go to the next section of elements and you sign on that. Or if, and in this case, if you run in, you know, start butting heads on one of the elements in that group of elements, then at that point, you can go out and ask for somebody to come help you to sit down and get the two of you talking on the same wavelength. So when you go all the way through the phased application, now you have the first phase through whatever phase, and you'll find out in one of those areas what it is the school board's looking for. When we talked about this in the subcommittee, one of the things that came up was you may find, as a school board, you may find why this group of people want to step out of the public school and start the charter school, and that if you just change something in your current operation, you may drag them all back. So it was something that was that with the idea that it would work both ways. If you drag them back, you may have them back in a school within a school or another charter school within, you know, that was better set up in the district. But the whole idea was you go through one step at a time, you find out where the school board's problems were before the entire application was put out.
Senator Nicholas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand now, I think, what you're having. And I tell you, if you think that in this process, having a completeness review is what, if you're taking it and taking that idea over to DEQ, that somehow determining whether your application is complete is going to get you to the end game. It won't. It just won't happen. And I submit to you, you're putting about two more layers in there that's going to make everybody more frustrated, more expensive. And at the end of the day, the board, I assume, you're not taking the decision away from the board to deny or approve the application. And the denial and approval is far more complicated. It is, well, do we have the facilities to support it? How many kids are you going to take out of our district? Are you insisting that you use one of our local schools to educate it? And maybe I'll just ask, that's the next issue. Are we intending to make it easier for charter schools to be created? If so, how many? One per community, three community? And are we going to pay for these facilities every time they're created? And are we going to decide as a state what type of innovation we're prepared to pay for?
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This really doesn't pertain to making it easier or more difficult to start a charter school. I know that there are some other bills floating around the Capitol here somewhere that does deal with that. This is just simply a way of ensuring a more fair process for everybody. And this is a result of proponents of charter schools coming forward and saying, my gosh, we put all this effort into putting an application together. We thought it was complete. We thought we met the letter of the law. We gave it to the school board. And then they went through the hearing process, which can be rather arduous, as was explained, in 21-3308. They went in to look at the level of community and parental support, the level of teacher support for this. They had public meetings with the community. They went through that whole process, which could last 90 days. And then at the end of the 90 days, the school board comes back and says, well, we're kind of convinced after talking with everyone that there's the support for it, but going back to your application, the section under number 14 wasn't sufficient, and therefore we're going to knock out the application because of that. And folks just throw their hands up in the air and say, well, wait a second. Why didn't you tell us then? Or why didn't you give us an opportunity to correct it at that point? We have to start back over again. It's very expensive. And so what everyone agreed to, including the school districts and the Department of Education and the State Board of Education, is let's have a process up front to where both groups, the charter school applicant and the school districts, agree that a completed application has been submitted before starting through the hearings and determining if there's a support in the community. So let's all agree that on point number one, when we go out to the community and talk with them, that the application we have in our hand is complete, that both parties agree to that. If they don't, then the State Board of Education, if this bill were to pass, may develop a system of mediation in which both groups can go and say, no, Section 14 is not complete. Yes, Section 14 is complete. Work out their differences. If they can't, then the Board of Education can step in and make a decision on that particular point. It does lengthen it. Okay, at either point, you know, of course, the folks who submit the charter school application can pull it and say, hey, it's not worth it. You know, or the State Board of Education can agree and it can move forward to a full application. This is just getting them to point one and making sure that everybody is in agreement that a complete application has been submitted, and then they go from there. It's not about increasing or decreasing the number of charter schools.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, that's helpful. And so over on page 3, on lines 12 through 14, we still give the district board the ability to either approve or deny, and we don't have any real requirements for them to measure it against. They have almost ultimate authority to decide. Going back to the explanation, I understand the explanation. I think it might be helpful to know whether your application is technically complete. But, folks, that doesn't mean that by any chance that the members of the school board believe that it's adequate or appropriate. And I think I understand what the proponents of the bill want. They would like a process, not that determines whether the application is technically complete. They want to know, is the application meet your approval such that if we meet each one of these things, you'll be obliged to approve it? And the problem is there are two different concepts. I go back to DEQ permits. For people of you that have experience with DEQ permits, you go in and the staff determines whether or not it's technically complete. There, the assumption is if it's technically complete and you meet all the requirements of state law, you're entitled to get your permit. Until, of course, somebody comes in and objects and we don't think it provides enough protection for the health, safety, and welfare of landowners or the public, in which case you get into a hearing and somebody's got to make a decision. And my fear is that, like I was, in fact, a witness called to testify for on the Cheyenne. I understand the frustration. My fear is, in an effort to try to make this thing more streamlined, you're just putting more money, more opportunity for anger. If you think mediation processes are fun, believe me, they ain't. And if you think that they resolve disputes where people are diametrically opposed about whether or not you have a charter school, they don't. And if you're the result is all you get is an agreement that say, fine, we agree that the application is technically complete. Now, I'm a board member, and I don't have to tell you, nor would I disclose to you whether or not and how I'll vote at the end. Because I'm an elected board member, I get to make the decision, and the only thing that I have to decide before is whether or not, you're telling me I have to tell you in advance, before I deliberate and make my decision, that the applicant is application is technically complete? Fine. It's technically complete, you do it at the first stage, you don't even help them. In fact, that's what will happen. From now on, the first application comes in, you say that's technically complete, you have the hearing the next day, you say don't like it, that's it. And I get to turn it down, that's the result. And you don't solve a problem. I understand the problem. I just don't think it gets you there.
Discussion, Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we just don't have a process in place right now. There's nothing out there that's there. There is no phased-in application process. There's a process where somebody presents an application for a charter school and the district says, we don't like it, and they turn it down. And there's no means in place to go in and mediate that. Now, I want to emphasize that in the phased-in application process one more time, either side can initiate it, may initiate it, but there's just nothing in place that defines how the process works right now. You mentioned that you said that the state board doesn't have a history of being friendly to charter schools. I can promise you that school districts don't have a history of being favorable to charter schools. It just doesn't happen out there. Now, there's one up and running and doing very well in Laramie. But I'll tell you, there's been a number of them around the state where it's been difficult. I'm not necessarily a charter school advocate, but I think if we're going to have something in place, rules in place, ground rules in place, we ought to treat both sides somewhat equally and fairly, remembering that the funding process for charter schools is somewhat difficult because we come in, if a charter school application gets approved, we fund that school the first year at 2 times the ADM. Then it phases itself down to 1. So, you know, this bill came about as a result of a study topic designated by Management Council based on the subcommittee that worked with the good senator from Casper was co-chair along with the former senator from Green River. That's where all this comes about. But there's nothing in place right now unless we provide some mechanism, and I'm not going to debate the good lawyer from Laramie here on this issue or the good one from Laramie County after I get my brains kicked in, but on mediation. But there's just nothing in place right now if we don't pass this bill for both sides to be treated fairly and equally.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I agree entirely with what the chairman said, and in fact, there will be none after this is passed. The bill that we have right now was drafted over in the House by legislator from Albany County and one from Campbell County. We spent the entire night drafting it over the course of events. It came for the legislation was adopted partly from the Colorado charter school law, and it got passed to try to accommodate differences between two views. One view that it ought to be absolute discretion of the school board to make these decisions, and an effort of create a new application process. The legislation that we adopted ended up with a provision that the decision for all practical purposes of granting a charter school resides with the school board that's elected. It's absolute and barely appealable. And that was the way it was drafted. And that was the checks and balances that we put in the statute to make sure that we didn't wake up the next morning and have a whole bunch of charter schools that we'd have to pay for, and in fact, in Lincoln, if you recall, in Laramie County, there was a school board was shutting down a school, And they were saying, why can't we do a charter school? So you have, if for example, the school board in Albany County decides that they need to shut down Centennial, they wouldn't do that, hopefully. What prevents them to do it, and what prevents the next group from coming in and get started? We were scared about that. And I understand exactly what you say, and this bill does not fix that, nor will it. All it does is say we're going to engage in a couple more levels of assistance to get you through an determination that your application is technically complete. Technically complete. Doesn't mean that we like it. Doesn't mean that we'll approve it. And if you put in, if you say it's 9 months and frustrating and you don't like the outcome, wait till it's 2 years and you've now paid a mediator, thrown in another $50,000 of attorney's fees, and the decision of the board is the same. You think you're mad then. Wait till you spend all that money in an extra year. And all you said, well, we worked on, you told us that the application was technically complete. Well, yeah, we didn't tell you we liked it or that we'd approve it. We just told you it's technically complete. Am I missing the boat? Go ahead.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not solving the problem that my colleague from Laramie is bringing up, because it's not meant to solve that problem. The board and the school board has lots of different things and lots of different factors in which it must weigh a complete application. And we're not trying to change that at all. We're not trying to get a more favorable or less favorable outcome for charter school applicants. All we're saying is that as they move forward with all these other factors that they got away, is to make sure that they agree they have an application in front of them. Otherwise, if we just continue with the situation now, and here's the problem we're trying to solve, is that the charter school folks believe that they've submitted a complete application. The school board doesn't think it's complete, and they don't have any timeline in which they have to get back to them and say, sorry, it's not complete. They could go through the entire process and at the very end say, well, in reality, we don't have a complete application to start with. All the other factors are fine. We just didn't have a complete application to start with. So we're not trying to solve all these other problems. All we're trying to say is that the board of the Department of Education will come up with a process and some timelines to say, submit a complete application, and when we agree upon that, then we'll go through all the rest of the things that my colleague talked about.
Are you ready for the question? Senator Sessions.
Another part of the bill, but I will tell you, I sort of was part, not part of, but I read and was aware of all the stuff that went on in my district. And I will tell you, and maybe this, and I'll say it on the floor of the Senate, the unwillingness to do what was asked in the application was three quarters of the problem. And I sat in those hearings and listened to it. And I, just as an aside, one gentleman said to me, well, those kids can go to school over there. There's a warehouse available, such and such a place. And no, there isn't. So anyway, but here, I have a question here on this one. What it says, the page 4, line 18, it says, by any person other than the school district. So What we're saying here is, in order to have a charter school, is this correct, that a district cannot institute a charter school and receive the double funding for it to get it started, that it has to be an outside group? Is this correct or not? It has to be an outside group by any person other than the school district. Then the average daily membership will be multiplied by 2. So if any district starts to, they want to do an online program for, we know children with autism or emotionally disturbed problems, we know that there is a real connection there that they do very well in many instances with online classes, online schools, other than regular classrooms. So if my district says, or if they're going to, and this is maybe what's happened, I'm going to do an online school, because now we've gotten online schools that are very credible. They weren't for a while, but I think a lot of there are now for homeschool students. and I'm meeting with homeschool parents and things because sometimes, and a lot of homeschooled parents are being receptive to an online school. But then that means that my school district or anybody's school district cannot institute that as a charter school to get it started for 2 years. Is that correct?
Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, to my understanding, the good senator from Cheyenne is absolutely correct. And the reason I believe that the reason that she's correct is because anything that she just described in the public school system would not be a charter school. It would be a program. So if you wanted to put a new web-based charter school together in there, then you'd have to do it with the funds on the ADMs that you already get. The idea of the double funding on the charter school is that you're not in the facility, you're not using the ADMs that you're already getting in the block grant, that you're set out here different, and the double funding gets you going. If you want to start a program and call it charter school, then what we would do is that we would have districts that would be stepping out of their grant blocks, and they could say, well, this is my new charter school, so send me that much more ADM on this number of kids. And I think that's what we're looking at, and I don't think it would work. So the good senator is absolutely right.
Ready for the question on the bill?
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 62, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 62 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 6. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise in support.
Heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion passes. Mr. President.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had unconsideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 129, do pass amended. Senate File 140, do pass amended. Senate File 143, do pass amended. House Bill 4, do pass. House Bill 12, do pass. House Bill 55, do pass amended. House Bill 5, do pass. House Bill 9, do pass amended. House Bill 25, do pass amended. And House Bill 62, do pass amended. Senator Honeycutt, Chairman.
Senator Honeycutt.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You voted the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
As opposed, no. Report that's adopted. Messages from the House.
This is messages from the House.
No messages. Okay. Introduction of the bill now. Okay. Introduction, reading, and reference of bills. Senate File 1, first reading of the bill.
Senate File Number 1, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee, General Government Appropriations.
Pursuant to Joint Rule 14-1B2, Senate File 1 is referred directly to the Committee of the Whole. Standing Committee Reports.
February the 9th, 2009, Mr. President, your Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development. to whom was referred House Bill 156, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. February the 9th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 71, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. February the 9th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 251, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. February the 9th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 119, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Nicholas, do you have a report to give to us?
Thank you, Mr. President. Folks, earlier this morning, we handed out, it said Nicholas with 2-9, and it's a revenue sheet, and it's straight-up sheet. The first page is a summary sheet that our folks in our budget office prepared. The second page is items with respect to revenues that were laid out by the Division of A&I. Before I go into it, let me just talk about the purpose of the discussion. You know, historically, and I remember when I first, before I got in JAC, it upset me when the chairman got up every time and said there's no money. And you hear that so many times that you wonder in the end, what can you believe and what's out there? And the answer is that I always felt was to bring everybody up to speed so you can assess for your own where we're going with respect to revenues, what its likely impact is on the budget, and as you begin to decide and vote on items, how you're going to vote, kind of get a picture of the end game, where you think you want to be. And the issue that has us all haunted or worried right now is, what about our fiscal profile? The Consensus Revenue Estimating Group is an informal group that was established back in about 1983. Prior to that, the legislature estimated its own revenues and decided what they wanted to do. The governor executive branch did their own estimates. So in 83, there was an agreement to create the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group. The co-chairmans are the head of our budget office, and the head of the other co-chair is with the Division of A&I, their budget estimating group, or actually it'd be their economic analysis group. And so they get together, and while there's no statutory requirements, the assumption is that they'll get together in October in advance of the governor having to provide a budget. They make an estimate, and our statutes do say that you're required to make a balanced budget based upon those estimates. Then historically, the group has come back and met in January. We're required, and we have been traditionally passing out a balanced budget based upon what the CREG believes your revenues are in January. There's no reason why the CREG group couldn't meet today or tomorrow. And at any given time, every time they meet, they will have different revenue assumptions. For those of you that spend any time with actuaries, it's like an actuary. Every time you send an actuary out to do any type of an estimate of what you want, it's different on that day based upon on your information and on the income, the revenues, assumptions that day. So what I'd like to do with you is explore to you a little bit about what those estimates that are in your goldenrod were based upon, and how they're soft and what the concerns that we are and what we may expect if things don't get come out the way was believed in when the Craig group met. So on the first sheet, what you see there is natural gas prices, and I think I've already told you, and I think you all understand, the impact of natural gas prices on our budget. The Craig group in January estimated the fiscal year 2009 revenues for natural gas at $3.75. Now, while we had some early good months, everybody knows that we are not at 3.75 today. We're about 3.60 in that range. 3.61 is that. In fact, that's an Opal, my recollection, 3.61 is the Henry Hub rate. And I need to, I sometimes get mixed up on that, but the point is we're neither, whether it's the Henry Hub or whether it's the Opal Hub, we're not there. Now, the assumption of the gas prices was is that we would be seeing $5 gas in our best months would be January and February, and that the $5 gas would then pick up the average. Remember, 375 is your average, so you've got to have some pretty sensational months above, or you have to have months above that to draw your average up, and typically January and February are the months that pull up. Now, last summer was an anomaly. We had some high gas prices when oil hit $140 a barrel. We saw some pretty extraordinary gas prices. I don't think anybody believes that that's going to take place this summer. And the 2010 fiscal year estimates are at 425. And then if you go drop down, the Craig estimates are based upon $40 a barrel for oil and $50 for 2009 fiscal year and $50 for 2010. We asked the staff to say, well, just show us what the impact would be at some other levels. And the staff picked $3 for, so suppose we drop down $3 on natural gas, drop it down by 75 cents, and do a similar drop on the 2010. And I'll tell you right now that at least our staff, one member of the Craig group, would tell you right now that they have real concerns whether we'll hit an average of $3 for this fiscal year. Remember the numbers. The numbers will go like this. For every drop of $1 per MCF in the price of natural gas on our budget, we see direct reduction of severance taxes essentially to the budget reserve and general fund of about $125 million. And that same dollar drop results in about $107 million to our school foundation program account. But the impact on the school foundation program account is about 2 years beyond what your present pricing, because when that is an ad valorem tax, so the 2008 ad valorem is actually paying its tax in 2010, the way it works out. So while there is some insulation that we will see over the course of the next year to the school foundation program account, because we're receiving taxes that are on valuations that are a couple of years behind, the flip side of it is that the low cost now has reverberations 2 years down, a year and a half, 2 years down the line to our school foundation program account. So then you begin to really think about what is the picture, the lay of the land, look like in 2011, 2012 for the next biennial budget. Now we'll talk about that in a little bit more. But in this scenario, we simply said if the natural gas were to drop down to $3, the average for the year, and $3.50 for 2010, and of course you see the reduction in oil prices, you're going to see a reduction in the general fund by $212 million. So then part of the next issue is what do you do and how do you make up $212 million to your general fund budget reserve account? Remember, folks, this is not the impact to your school foundation program account, and we haven't discussed it in this scenario because it's delayed. And we just went through the exercise of just saying, well, what are your available resources if we recasted our numbers today? Well, there was $75 million to the LSRA and unspent from the JAC recs, which is rapidly, actually probably gone under today's analysis. There's $96 million in the statutory reserve. That's the 5% that we set aside in the statutory reserve account. It's $104 million in the present goldenrod. It drops down a little bit because of a lower budget reserve or a general fund estimate as we start seeing new sheets tomorrow. I believe it'll show up tomorrow. When we began, we had $63 million in a committee of the whole bills that are profiled. If you look at it today, if you look at the committee or the budget reserve expenditures, it's now up to $87 million. So $63 million was an old number. There is $165 million in the budget bill that came out of the JAC, and that was a reduction over the governor's. You add that to the $87 million now on committee of the whole, that means all those bills have at least made it through the committee of the whole of the respective houses. You have a total spending of $252 million. No more savings into the LSRA, and much of that is ongoing dollars that we'll have to address. Other revenues funds, you have the $353 million in the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account, our rainy day account. The Spending Policy Reserve account is $102 on that line. There is AML funding that we've spent. There's about $70 million of AML spending that's in the budget you'll see tomorrow. There's $37 million in capital complex appropriation. Those are reserves that we sent off and set aside in past years. There's $25 million in budget reserve transfers to the water accounts. And folks, if you have an objective to keep water account monies in water account, you want to keep those savings, the best way you do it is you stop spending. Where did we balance our accounts and we didn't have enough money? We went to the water account. And so, you know, it's sort of a pep talk. I mean, as I see, you have some people that will never spend. You have some people that will always spend, and then you have people in the middle that are trying to figure out where's your rudder, where's the end game, and this is the time to start thinking about it before we undertake the budget. Down below, underneath the budget, in the both in statute and in our budget, there's provision for the governor. If he determines, and in fact, the section 311 to the existing budget says every 6 months, if the governor is supposed to review all agency budgets and expenditures every 6 months, if the governor determines during the review that the probable receipts for the following 6 months periods from taxes or other sources of revenue for any fund or account which is less than anticipated, that is less than the goldenrod, and if the governor determines that these receipts plus existing expenditure revenues in the fund or account, which are available during the six-month period, will be less than the amount appropriated, the governor may, within 60 days after reviewing the budget, shall give notice to the state agencies concerned and reduce the amount of their appropriations to reduce a budget. That's, for those who have been around, you'll recall that at least twice before, the governor, while the legislature was out of session, did a 5% across-the-board cut to all agencies. There had been deferrals furloughs in the past. But in this case, if you look at what the governor has available to him over the biennium, if he determined that if he doesn't have to have the Craig group meet, but one of the main things he could do is, and he just does his analysis and says, we are underwater based upon today's numbers because are not meeting the Craig estimates, and he implements a 5% across the board hit. If he did it at the beginning of the biennium, that would generate about $175 million. But to generate 5% across the the budget to initiate to get that entire 175. You got to do it on the first day that the budget is implemented. If he does it this July, which is the second year of the biennium, a 5% across the board cut only generates $87.7 million. So I'm trying to put that in context. If you're trying to pick up $200 million worth of revenue, you'd have to put more than a 10% across the board cut. On the next page is sort of saying the same thing from the other budget analysts that are also members of the Craig group. And the numbers are a little bit different. I mean, you could spend a lot of time sorting them out, but there are some interesting issues there. We're being told that the 2009 budget for major companies is going to have are forecasted to be 45 to 50% less number of rig counts. If that happens, those rigs go away. They don't come back. I've got another report that says you have to have $8 natural gas in order to justify having some of the exploration you're seeing there. And the question is when do you start seeing that type of dollar to bring those rigs back online? And I'll point out in a minute, those have huge impacts. The next page is we asked A&I last week, say, give us some indicators of what is happening to the Wyoming economy. And take a look at your unemployment statistics. In January 2008 to January 2009, we are up 98%. For kid care closures and denials, what's happening here are kids or families that are no longer eligible for SCHIP. So you got 1,300 families moving off or becoming ineligible from fiscal year 08 to 09. 1,300 families no longer can qualify. That would cause you to believe that they're heading off into Medicaid because they're no longer there. And now when you start looking down at the Medicaid increases, we see eligibles. But remember, while it's only 1.3%, you're dealing with larger numbers. You got 59,000 last year, 100. You got 59,800 this year. That's 773 new families. To what extent those are families that came off the SCHIP, we don't know. You just begin to look at those numbers. You've got recipients increasing on TANF. You've got a few changes, not huge. Your food stamps, you've got changes. Medicaid appropriations, you could start seeing there. The LEAP. Now, the LEAP, there's been a lot of advertising, which might account for some of that that increase. Your child care subsidies, remember that if families are losing, one member of the family is losing their job, they may be taking care of their own family, but we're still seeing increases. So, I mean, you can look at those numbers and try to get a feel for what's happening. When you turn over to the next page, which is the monthly comparisons of use tax collections, the use tax collections for 2008 are down by 4.8% change. We're underwater at minus 0.04%. When you look down at year-to-date comparisons of sales to use tax, you're seeing a reduction there of a minus 0.6.2 to minus 10.6% at the bottoms. The next page is kind of an interesting page. That shows you the sales and use tax, and while you'll recall that we've seen increases last year in sales taxes. Take a look at use taxes. So use taxes are your equipment that's purchased somewhere else, brought into the state, and look where the real significant changes are. Campbell County, minus 17. Natrona, minus 16. Sublette, minus 27. Sweetwater, minus 18%. Total state, minus 10%. So you would expect, I suppose, a lot of the use tax to ramp up as you're bringing new equipment into the state. You're anticipating that you're going to be doing new development. And at some point you would expect, I suppose, that it tables out because you don't need to bring more equipment in. But the part of the question you have is that sort of anticipating what's going to be happening, at least in some of those areas, for your sales tax in the years to come. You are seeing, folks, some significant things and warnings, if you will, or take it how you want, this budget is changing. And the budget that we're, as we sit and talk about spending, and as you start to sort out what you're thinking, and the amount of money that you want to put into the legislative stabilization reserve account, amount of the income, it's not going to affect this budget or whether or not the governor is forced to or does exercise his 5% reduction during this year. But it will impact when you come back, whether he has exercised that 5% or not, the ability, our ability to sustain a budget at this level or at a reduced level in the next biennium. It affects whether or not you're going to be able to pay for some of the big ticket items, which are local governments, your highway construction, and your one-time type of capital constructions. So a couple points, I guess, as I look through, the points I want to make is that we are operating on forecasts, simply forecasts. Craig will meet without the call of the chairman at least four more times before we finish this budget. They'll meet October of 09, January of 10, each of which is an opportunity to reduce your revenues. They'll meet again in October 2010 and January 11 as we're finishing out the biennium with another opportunity to reduce your revenues. So four times they're going to meet. They can meet on the call of the chairman, and I suppose if the governor asks them to meet, they may choose to meet. So that and the school foundation program impacts are going to roll in a little more slowly. They will hit. Each time that you put in new spending means that it's harder to pay for the things that are already in the budget. If you want to generate a 5% savings, that means that you have to spread it along a larger subset of budgets. We don't have this notion in government spending where the last thing we funded is the first thing we cut. Doesn't weigh the work. You put something in over the course of the next 4 or 5 days, or we pass it out. Once it's in law, it stands shoulder to shoulder with every other appropriation, which includes the basic fundamental government spending that's been in there for a long time, and it shares in the 5% cut just like everybody else. But it doesn't get a disproportionate amount. You don't cut out programs. They exist. In a sense, the more spending you make, the more you crowd out your existing budgets and what's already there, and it means that you're going to be seeing cuts to budgets that you may think are far more essential and fundamental than the things that you may be voting over the course of the next week. You know, for those of us that were here in the late 1990s, we remember what it's like to come down and have to cut budgets. Since then, we've become accustomed to the notion that every time Craig meets, that they generate more revenue for us to spend. And we're probably right now on a reverse trend, where every time that Craig meets, they're going to reduce that revenue, which means it's got to be made up somewhere. And in light of the fact that you're likely to see revenue, I mean, no doubt today, if Craig met today, they would reduce their forecast. I don't think there's anybody that should believe otherwise here. And the likelihood is if they meet in the next 3 or 4 months, they will reduce their forecast of revenues. And so if you know that's going to happen, would you rather be saving now so you have some money to sustain your budgets later, or would you rather be spending now and just have bigger cuts later? And at the same time, it's not all doom and gloom. We have a pretty strong budget. We've got a $3.5 billion of spending out there. We have an LSRA that I wish was larger, but it's significant. It's not large enough for many years, but it's there. But we shouldn't be creating circumstances where we have to spend the LSRA all in 2 years. only to have to cut your budget. I think the last rainy day accounts, we expended through them slowly over a course of about 10 years. And so that's sort of, I guess, get ready to make votes. Think about every vote. You're right now at about $258 million of spending, so if we pass every bill and the budget the way it is right now, we would spend every carryover dollar we have, only making the next session a harder session. Mr. President, thank you, and don't mean to be too doom and gloom about it, but that is the lay of the land.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. President, I want to thank the Chairman of Appropriations for his very good information. But staff has been sitting for quite a long time without a break. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, if there are no further reports, I would move that the Senate be adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Okay. Announcement, Senator Coe.
Mr. President, your committee number for education meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock over S-11 by the smoking lounge to hear House Bill 94, Attorneys, Requirements for Admission to the Bar. I thought you just had to be 21. House Bill 155, Higher Education Matching Funds. House Bill 173, Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program. And House Bill 33, Engrossed Expanded Opportunity Pilot Program.
Senator Von Platerman.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, will meet in about 10 minutes in S-13 to review House Bill 47, Engrossed Commercial Signage and Highways, House Bill 51, Engrossed Handicapped Motorcycle Plates, House Bill 113, Engrossed Careless Driving, House Bill 83, Engrossed Governmental Immunity Public Transportation.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, Committee Number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow at 30 minutes after the noon recess, Caddy Corner from the Smoking Lounge over on that corner over there, as far away from ill health as we can get. We are going to take up, Mr. President, House Bill 22, Engrossed, Qualification for Veterans Tax Exemption, House Bill 84, Engrossed, Economic Development, Property Tax Exemption, House Bill 138, Engrossed, Property Tax Refund Program, and if we get time, we'll look at House Bill 221, Property Tax Appeals 2.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet tomorrow, Tuesday, at 8 a.m. in S-19 at the top of the stairs. We're going to take up and finish House Bill 10, Engrossed, which we've laid over since our last meeting, then move on to House Bill House Bill 10, Mr. President, Subdivisions Requirements, House Bill 35, Election Judges, House Bill 74, Water and Sewer Districts Maps. That's going to be exciting. I hope you'll be there for that, Mr. President. House Bill 78, Improvement in Service Districts. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Burns.
President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet tomorrow at 20 minutes after the noon recess up in S-14. We will take up House Bill 6, Engrossed Game and Fish Trapping, House Bill 84, Engrossed Game Bird Farms Raising Sage Grouse, and House Bill 225, Engrossed Bighorn Sheep, Ewe, and Lamb Licenses. And, Mr. President, tomorrow at lunch is the Secretary's Salad. And we would appreciate it if the other members would let the members of both travel and revenue go first, since they have lunch meetings. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Reading Clerk.
Senators, at the pleasure of Mr. President, I had a copy of this handed out. It's the Cheyenne Quarterback Club, along with the Cowboy Joe Club, is having a Honor the Senior Night Wednesday at 6 o'clock at the Holiday Inn. All of the senior football players will be there. The Cheyenne Quarterback Club presents them with a senior ring. You will also be able to meet the new head football coach. And I know you're used to having most of these being free, but this one would cost you $19. And you could also, if you so desire, you can buy the dinner for a senior football player and have him set at your table, and you would be able to visit with him. It is casual you don't need to wear a tie. And I'd like to do a RSVP, so if any of you are interested in going, let me know and I will call it in, and would hope to see a number of you there. Thank you, Mr. President.
You've heard the motion. The Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, February 10th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. We are adjourned.